Gone through the first six, and not necessarily that they're listed in the order that I've done them, but we've gone through, we looked at pride, and then envy, gluttony, wrath or anger, and then greed, lust, which leaves us with the one I've left till last, and that is sloth, is a traditional name for it, or laziness. And it might be a little bit of surprise when you think about that. How is that so deadly, you know? Laziness or slothfulness, as the traditional older terminology is for it. Sloth, most of you probably know, is actually an animal. They're known to sleep upwards of 18 hours out of every 24 hours. All I could tell you is I went to the Bronx Zoo a couple weeks ago, and they had an exhibit with a sloth. I don't think it was alive. You know, I think the zoo could get away with a lot of just have a taxidermist place animals in the exhibits. You ever go to look at the crocodiles? They never move. They just are there, you know. And if you hang out for about a half hour, oh, I think he twitched his tail, you know. It's like, but the sloth was the same way. He's like curled up, and I guess he's sleeping. And he's not moving, so I can see how they use that animal to represent laziness. And the Bible does repeatedly denounce laziness. Probably one of the most prominent places is in our men's Bible study. We've been going through Proverbs, and it's really a predominant theme. We always know when it's Astrid's phone, right? That's one of the nice things about a small congregation. All right, yep, she always has a traditional ring, and she never silences it, you know, and that's okay. There's certain privileges at 92, you know. But anyway, we've been going through Proverbs in our men's group a little bit, and it's a theme. It's in there all the time. The value of hard work and the evils of laziness. They're all in there here. I'll just read you one. Proverbs 10, verses 4 and 5. It says, "Lazy hands make a man poor, but a diligent hands bring wealth. He who gathers crops in the summer is a wise son, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son." Ancient Israel was an agricultural society. Most people made their living by farming. So often the examples have to do with farming. Even Jesus did that a lot, as you know, like the planter of the seed and the reaper of the seed, or sowing and reaping of the seed. We're going to talk about that a little bit in a little while. But here, the point being is that you have to think back to this, going back about 2,800 years, when people mostly made their living from farming, and the bottom line is unwillingness to work literally could lead to starvation. I mean, you know, maybe some people can work the ropes a little bit today with laziness and still scratch out a living, you know? It wasn't possible back then. There wasn't any social problem programs unless you actually did what the Bible said, but the Bible never would enable laziness. Widows were provided for, orphans and so forth in the law, but there's just simple common sense here that, listen, if you don't farm your land, man, and if you have a son that sleeps through the harvest, you and your family just might starve to death. There's a reality to working. The Hebrew culture was really big on a healthy work ethic. And it was still in place 800 years later when that Jewish guy wrote in his letter to the Thessalonians, the Apostle Paul, when he said, you know what? The one who is unwilling to work won't eat. That's pretty simple theology right there. So unquestionably, there's a harm. There's an evil that comes and does come out of laziness. And there's definitely people and there's cultures that can benefit from that message, absolutely. But I'll just be honest with you this morning. I don't think that's our problem. That's another advantage of having a small church. I pretty much know all of you guys pretty well. And you are all hard workers. And I'm not really interested in preaching a message to people who aren't here this morning. So I'm thinking about this. So what am I going to talk about? Well, that's it. We're done. You always wanted that shorter sermon, right? Well, no, of course not. But I was thinking about this, and we do live in a world that is, by some so-called experts, say we are probably one of the most workaholic cultures in the history of the world. And I've experienced, been there, done that myself. Even globally, you can look at, you just Google it. Look at a typical work day for some South Koreans or Japanese, even other people groups, is 10, 14-hour days easily. And we know, especially maybe even more so in the New York area, that is a normative experience for a lot of people. It's just the way the world is around here and the way it's been working. And so in most cases, I think right here, even in America, again, maybe even more so in New York area, perhaps we are far from lazy when it comes to work. You're just not. I know you're not. But in so doing, we can become lazy when it comes to spiritual concerns because we burn ourselves out so heavily that there's little energy or time to commit to the things that matter most, according to the Bible. And so we get lazy in that department. We don't leave any energy reserves when it comes to the spiritual things of life. You know what? I'm just going to plug this in right here. If you want to hear the spiritual antithesis of what can be typical here in the Western world, I want you to mark your calendars for October 22nd. Because what we're going to do is we're going to lure you in by having something to eat over at the Hennigan's house with very nice soft chairs so we can endure a little slothfulness, okay? Have something to eat and relax. But what we're going to do is I want to let Nancy have some time to just explain to you what a week is like in a missionary family's life that lives in a predominantly Muslim nation of Indonesia and what that is like. She just spent a week. She got to tell me a little bit about it. We went on the Habitat for Humanity work day yesterday, and on the ride there and back, she got to explain some of what she did this last week. Nancy has felt called. I think she's in the position she's supposed to be in as a mobilizer for our missions. And we've always said we want us to be more than just supporting our missions financially, but how can we practically, in a way, support these people? She was talking with a couple that spent 12 years, you ready for this, in Afghanistan. How do you do that? With the physical persecution that happens, she talked about how the mother was talking about how the father was out doing some work. And, you know, we're so used to rights, right? Everybody's about our rights. I have the right. I have the right to be heard. You don't have the right. There's no rights. They want to go in your house. Guess what? They go in your house. They search around. They look. They would just bust in. The military would just bust into this missionary lady's house and take whatever they want. The one thing she wanted was her phone so she could at least communicate to her husband. And so Nancy said she ditched it in her infant son or daughter's diaper so they wouldn't find it, praying that her husband wouldn't call while they're searching the apartment. I mean, these are things that are completely out of my, you know, realm of thinking. And the level of diligence, lack of laziness in the spiritual realm that is necessary for something like that. But you know what? I often find, and I hope you'll mark your calendars, October 22nd. We're going to take some time and just sit down and hear about the Coonies. We even put in there, who are the Coonies? Because we're even concerned that people don't even know who the Coonies are. And if you don't, then you need to come. And our other missions. But often what missionaries will say that I've heard said before is, man, that's dangerous. I don't know how you do that. They are worried for us even more because of the spiritual danger that we are in, that we can be so easily, that the demon of slothfulness very subtly works his way into our life and kind of just lulls us to sleep in our comforts and our conveniences because we don't have any impending physical dangers to drive us to our knees often. And it can be frightening. It can be scary. And so there is more potential, I think, for this enemy of sloth in the spiritual realm to just move into our homes because we are busy, but you know that acronym, right? Being under Satan's yoke, doing so many other things. Why do I say this? First of all, I just thought of a couple things. How about this? We don't even have a Sabbath, really, anymore. There's no such thing as that, and somebody might be, well, isn't that kind of legalistic, Greg? You know, what are you going to start saying? You can't work for 24 hours or something. And I want to just say this. I get tired of everybody claiming legalism all the time because you know what? Most of the time it's just a smokescreen for the desire to want to compromise. Really, you know? That's what it is, you know? Well, I just want out, man. I want sloth to be able to have its way, so we'll just call it legalism, and then everybody feels like, you know, somehow like cornered that, well, I don't want to be a legalist. You know, it's cutting-edge cool Christian to not be legal now, you know? And so we have no holiness. We have no sanctification because it's all considered legalism. Spiritual laziness and compromise in so many cases. In Jesus' day, we know they were carried away with the Sabbath. You know, they had so many rules and regulations. It was out of control. In fact, they had come up with some list that I saw called the, H-A-L-A-K-H-A-H, Halakha. And they put all of these lists of things that you couldn't do, work that wasn't allowed on the Sabbath. You know, there's still a lot of perhaps religious Jewish groups that have all of these laws, and you can't do a light switch. You can't do this, that, or the other thing. And they had all of these regulations so that there was no work on the Sabbath, and that was legalism. And Jesus would often challenge them on their legalism. And he would, go out and pick some grain and let his disciples eat some on the Sabbath, and they'd get all bent out of shape. They didn't even want him to heal somebody who was suffering physically because it was the Sabbath, and he'd go and do it anyway. And famous line in Luke 7, he says, what's lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? They had completely lost the spirit and intent of the Sabbath. But here's my point. Jesus' day, people suffered from all of the regulations surrounding Sabbath. We are suffering because we have no regulations and we don't even have a Sabbath. We may be suffering even more from the exact polar opposite of what their problem was. I tell you, I've seen it disappear in my lifetime. You know, I mean, even just culturally, the society would help kind of create a rhythm in your week so at least you could have some downtime. You know, and I'm not just talking a Sabbath solely for rest. I mean, the idea is that we rest from our work so that we can really reflect on Christ's work. You know, that we're a lot more than just work. There's something bigger there. There's no time. We don't take any time. I remember back in 1990, and this is going to really frighten you, and I'll explain it. I got hired by Apple Computer right away. Joel's like, man, Lord have mercy. They got Greg over at Apple Computer. Mikey. He's like, what the heck? What are they hiring him for? It was just the shipping, because they wanted to make sure that the right stuff went out. Man, I tell you, I would get in there at 8 in the morning. Those guys were all, there were guys in the sales department already been there for 2 hours. And often I wouldn't get out of there till 8 o'clock, and they're still there. I remember one older guy, this is 1990, he'd been in the retail for, I don't know, over 40 years. So that brings us back at that point all the way to the early 50s, late 40s. He goes, I've seen the total transformation of this market, of the retail market. He goes, man, when I first got in this, we used to look forward to holidays. You know, Washington's birthday or something like that, we'd get it off. Now it means even more work. They have a sale on all of those days. There's no downtime. Listen, let me tell you something. The culture is militantly opposed to you taking spiritual time. It's going to wear you out. There's only 24 hours in a day, and there's only so much energy in a day, and the devil wants to position us that all of your energy is going to be poured in to entertainment and work and everything else, and there's nothing left to give to God. And it's okay because, you know, we live in the Western world, and we're not going to suffer persecution, and we figure out a way to run Christianity full of compromises. And anybody gets worried about it, we just call it legalism. Let me just read, I saw this article, pretty insightful, about the culture that the work culture that we live in right now. First thing, just four quick points. First one is that jobs are more insecure than they've ever been. Everybody's worried about losing their job because you know what? It's all about turning a profit, man. And if you don't turn a profit, whole departments are let go. And individuals, but they'll just let the whole department go if they need to, if they want to. There's never been a place where job insecurity is higher than it's ever been. Now, there's some that are still in unions and so forth, and I understand that, but man, I'll tell you, I worked in the private sector for 15 years, and it's rough. Job insecurity is very, very real thing, and everybody's overworked. If you make a decent amount of money, you are expected, I'm telling you. I just told you about Apple Computer. If you want to keep your position, man, you are expected to put in an enormous amount of hours. And you know what? If you don't want to do it, there is a line of kids just waiting to take your position at probably half the salary that you do because they're fresh out of school and they can't get a job. And so there's this pressure of job insecurity, how people are having to work. And then when you got the other end where you're not making so much money, which I've been, then you got to work a second job. So then you do something else. I mean, first 15 years of our marriage, I delivered newspapers on the side. Now, all the jobs are disappearing too. Ain't no newspaper, you got this. Aren't no printing presses. There's a guy in town that made his whole living selling ink to printing presses. Gone. I don't know what people do for a living anymore. It's a weird world, total insecurity. And that brings us to technology. Technology is the next thing. And this drives Tina crazy because this is one of my areas that I fall trapped to is with this, we can work anywhere. So you know what we do? We work everywhere. You talk about no Sabbath, man. This is a Sabbath killer right here. Marriage killer. Kingdom killer, if we're not careful. Listen, it can be a great instrument like anything, but man, we got to be aware of its downside. We can work anywhere, so we work anywhere. And lastly, work has kind of become the centerpiece where we get our fulfillment now. This one's kind of interesting. I was reading about this one. We are no longer defined by who we are, but by what we do. Right? Isn't that, Christian, when somebody wants to try and define you, I know Christian, if they ask him, he'll say, well, you know, so what do you do? Well, I try to reflect the image of God. That's what I'm created to do. No. That doesn't do it. You know, what do you do? Oh, I'm a dental hygienist. Good. That's who you are. No, you aren't. But that's what, even in the maybe non-religious sector, the more just socially prescribed roles were more of people's identity. You were a mother, you were a father, you were a daughter, you were a son, and not anymore. It's you decide what you're going to do, and then you go to school to accomplish it, and that's who you are. And our identity gets all wrapped up in what we do and how much we make, and that's just how it seems to work now. When someone wants to really figure out who you are, they always ask, what do you do? And it's not about what do you do to get money so that you can pay your bills. It's actually trying to place an identity on you when you tell them what it is you do. It's not about how you pay your bills. And it's not about God. And what they called this was the, never heard this term before, I thought it was kind of cool. It's called the master narrative of a society. What's the master narrative of a society? When you look in the Bible, the way that the master narrative that would say, well, this is what this particular culture, this society is about, was found in the high places. You remember hearing that term in the Old Testament? And God would command them to go to the high places and take down the idols. Because this is your territory now, and this isn't what you're about, man. I mean, you look, there's still ruins. You could see where they would take the high places, and that's where they would build a building. You know, you didn't just put anything up on that mountain or the hill, man. You put up there what represented your master narrative, what you were about. You go to Greece, right? You go to Athens. What's on the Acropolis? The Parthenon, right? The temple to all of their gods. That's what they were about. Zion for Jerusalem, you know? And it goes on from there, and that's what they were about. What's interesting is in old Western world, what were the high places? They were usually the church spires. You know, the steeple was up there for not just for symbolic reasons, but there was a practical reason that you could tell that's where the main center of what they were about happened. Even the town meetings would take place often in the churches. And that would be now, what is the tallest? What are the high places now? Office buildings, right? Places where people can turn a profit. That's what we're about, man. That's our master narrative. That's what we're sucked into. I get sucked into it, and you get sucked into it. And it's intoxicating. It gets into you. And God knew our propensity on those things, and He put this fourth commandment to set aside a day, again, to rest, but also recognize that, you know what? We need to rest from our works and look at God and the work that He's done on our behalf. There's this Jewish author by the name of Judith Shulevitz. It was kind of cool because she's not necessarily a believer, but the biblical concept of Sabbath, man, she had some really cool insights on it. And she wrote this. She said, not even group leisure activities can do for us what the Sabbath rituals can do. You know, I mean, it's nice to rest and get a group of people together and go to the ball game or have dinner together or something like that, but she's saying that's all right, but that does not, that's that, and that's what people do for rest. Now, that has supplanted the idea of Sabbath, but it can never take the place of what the Sabbath was originally intended to do. Sabbath rituals could once be counted on because religious rituals no longer exist simply to promote togetherness. That's not the only reason they exist. She says they are designed to convey to us a story about who we are. The story told by the Sabbath of its creation, God rested and we rest in order to honor the image of the divine in us. To remind us there's more to us than our work. That's all people have. My gosh, the stock market dies and they die. Suicide. There's more to us than our work. It keeps our sloth from, if we would just recognize the importance of coming together, even just on a Sunday morning, it keeps our spiritual slothfulness in check to a certain degree. And reminds us what our master narrative really is. What we are really about. So I'm just going to end with three things that are at least points of real consideration, I think. How we can come against this demon of slothfulness making its way into our life. First one is, I think church attendance should be a priority. You never hear me say that one, right? Because I'm always worried about being accused of being the legalist. Hey, I'm done with that, man. I'm too old. You know? Listen, after doing this for a long time, I'll tell you something right now. As soon as I see somebody missing a significant amount of time, I know people have to work, people have jobs in the health industry and other things, and that's another thing. But when I just know, you know, we're into the second month now, and it's the first mark of spiritual sloth setting in and compromise coming into the life. To separate yourself from God's community is a compromise. You know, I always say that this Christianity isn't like some of the other more, I don't know, esoteric, you know, up in the sky type spiritualities where it's all about individual mysticism and you meditate and those kind of things. The community, a gathering of people together, is so embedded in the health of a Christian experience, you cannot go without it and expect to have the fullness of the experience of what the Bible is telling us Christianity is all about. Right from its inception, chapter 2, verse 44 of Acts, it says, and all those who believe were, guess what? Together. How do you like that? All the believers were together with all their bumps and bruises, all their annoyances, but man, it's worth doing the hard work because you are not going to do this alone. All the believers were together, and then a little bit later it says, day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple and breaking bread from house to house. See, we like to divide it. I don't believe in, you know, church. I believe in house church. Well, they went temple and house to house. There's benefits in coming together to celebrate God as a big group, and there is a benefit to coming together on a smaller scale. You know, if anybody had an excuse not to make church, it would have been the early church, man. I mean, they're under persecution. You know, they had to hide in caves and stuff to worship God. It would have been so much easier, man. Just forget it, because you know what? We come together, we're a target. You know, just stay home. It's so much safer. Let's don't get together. In fact, the book of Hebrews is believed to have been written to the Jewish believers at that time because they were really under the gun, man. Not only were they being persecuted, but they were being ostracized from their families for becoming part of this, this new sect of Judaism. And so this book was believed in part to be written as an encouragement to those Jewish, new Jewish believers that were really suffering persecution. And what does he say? Yeah, forget about church, man. You're just going to get blown up. You know this one. It's famous. But you need to understand the context, like I just said, that it was written. And I think we forget that. You know, we think a church is just a traditional thing, you know, and come on, you know, give me a break. Listen, man, this is how imperative, how important it is for us to come together. They're under heavy persecution, and the writer of Hebrews still writes in the letter, chapter 10, verses 24 and 25, and let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. That's number one. I think church is imperative. Jesus said he's putting this thing together and not even the gates of hell can come against it. Well, he can't put it together unless we come together. That's number one. Secondly, we've said this all along. I don't think Sunday's enough. It's not enough. Keep yourself involved with what other opportunities that we offer here. The guys are together every Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. I know. Don't give in to that slothfulness now. Come on now. It's a real way to militate against it, 6 a.m. You know, I know, listen, some of you got to be to work at 6 a.m. Isn't it funny? We get a paycheck. I'll work that out, man. Be there. Gotcha. Money, please. No paycheck. Later. It's funny how we just get caught up in the master narrative that's surrounding us rather than the one that's in this book. Listen, come out on October 22nd. Enjoy some extended time with one another and hear about how these missionaries live and what it's like to be a Christian in other parts of the world. Let's get out of our little isolated world and find out what God's body, what people are dealing with around the globe. And this Wednesday, we've already mentioned it, but I want to just say this Wednesday at 7 p.m. for the next month, we're going to be doing a series on the spiritual gifts. And Pastor Joel is going to do it. I think Joel is in his groove, man. I mean, we all know he's got a gift when it comes to music. I believe he's got a gift for teaching. And let's take advantage of it. You know what Paul says in chapter 12, verse 1 of 1 Corinthians? He says, concerning spiritual gifts, I don't want you to be uninformed. Did you know Paul said that? He goes, you know what, man? Spiritual gifts are a big deal. I don't want you to be ignorant when it comes to these things. And guess what? If Paul doesn't want you to be ignorant, either do we. So that's why we're having the class. He says, I don't want you to be uninformed. I don't want you to be unaware. And so we don't either. Spiritual gifts are so important that when Paul not only said, I don't want you to not be informed about this, I don't want you to be ignorant about these things, but then in a couple chapters later in 1 Corinthians 14:1, he said this, pursue love, which we all know. We're comfortable with that one. Even Habitat for Humanity likes that one, you know, as long as we don't say proselytize Jesus too much, you know. In other charitable organizations. Pursue love. Yeah, that's good. But then Paul doesn't stop there. He says, but also I want you to, and he doesn't just say desire. He says eagerly desire the spiritual gifts. Man, this thing, I want you to earnestly desire. I want you to eagerly desire. I want you to truly want them. Why? Because it's one of the elements that's going to set our gatherings together apart from other groups that get together. There's a supernatural element in the midst of our gathering. God wants to dispense something in our midst that's something more than our own abilities. Really? That's what he did on the day of Pentecost, right? He dispensed gifts into the midst of that thing so people couldn't just write it off as, yeah, well, that guy's got, you know, he's a good speaker, or that guy's got talent in music, he's a good teacher. You know, all those things are gifts from God, but there's a way we can write it off with natural abilities, man. Spiritual gifts, it's either God doing it, or it's not happening, or it's counterfeit. It says miracles of healing. I mean, real miracles of healing. See, what happens is this thing has been abused. People got carried away with emotionalism. And what's sad is so many churches have said, we're not even going to go there. They get so paranoid of the counterfeit, they never give the real thing of the Bible an opportunity to manifest itself. We're not going there. We're going to study this thing. I want to see, Joel's going to take us deep into this thing. Understand these gifts, man. They're supposed to be manifesting within our midst. Unexplained by natural phenomenon that somebody's going to bust out in a language they don't even know, man. And then Mike will be, I'm waiting for God. I told you, I'm waiting for God to give me an utterance in Japanese, and then Mike will interpret it. He said, Greg, man, I didn't know you knew Japanese. Neither did I. I'm just saying that that's what the Bible says. It's supposed to be an unexplainable supernatural element in our midst. Different gifts that he distributes amongst us. That's number two. Last one. We just can't neglect the importance of your personal time with God. You just can't, man. Hey, the quality of our corporate times are never going to reach their full potential if we don't have our own private times. You know, it's all connected. If we neglect our own private time, you're not just an island. It affects what happens here. On Sunday mornings. And listen, I know we're all over the spectrum on this. There's some people that God is maybe speaking to you that you need to expand this time to an hour or two. Other people, just to try and get into the habit of 5 minutes in the morning before you rush off into work could be massive. But you got to start somewhere. It's not an option. It's just not an option. I think the Psalms constantly remind us of the value of taking time at the beginning of the day. There's something about before all the madness hits, man. Getting up, just setting the alarm a little early and leaving yourself some margin in the time of your day, the schedule of your day, to be with God. Psalm 5:3 is a great one. In the morning, O Lord, you will hear my voice. In the morning, I will order my prayer to you and eagerly watch. And again, I'm not going there. I'm not allowing the smokescreen of legalism, you know? Oh, come on, we don't have to have a formal quiet time with the Lord now, do we? You know, I mean, doesn't the Bible say we can pray without ceasing, whatever I'm doing? You know, like, I can be, whatever, I can be at work and, you know, well, God is good and help me do this, Lord. And but, yeah, absolutely, that's biblical. Pray without ceasing. But guess what? Taking time out and having focus on God and God alone is also biblical. I mean, let me just ask you. How effective is it with you when your kids are multitasking? I'll go a step further. How effective is it with me when I try to talk to Tina while multitasking? I'm listening. Yeah. What'd you say? You know what the psalmist said? He said, you know what? Sometimes you just got to stop multitasking with God. You know, we want to do two things at once. Do this and pray. You know, I get a lot more done that way. You know? But the psalms say, listen, there's a time, man. Just cut all the multitasking. That's cool. That's biblical. But it's also biblical to just say, you know what? I'm putting it all aside, man, and I'm focusing on you. I love this one, 27:4. I'm sure you've heard it. That's basically where David's saying, stop the multitasking. He says, just have one thing, man. One thing to seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to meditate in His temple. Can we even do one thing today? Man, we are so like doing so many things at once. We need to come back to that and say, you know what? Even if it's just 5 minutes, man, I got to practice just doing one thing and gaze on the beauty of God. I think that's what he's saying. I'm just going to end with this. As I was thinking through this, and it's so darn convicting when you got to preach these things and not just listen to them, you know? But I just thought, you know how incredibly crafty the devil is. Because just the way he gains entrance into our lives, that he can take the hardest working people in the history, perhaps, of the world, and make us some of the laziest people in the areas that really count. Jesus said, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Then all the other stuff. Then all the other stuff. Joel, I'm hoping you're heading this way. I kind of think you might be. I think we need to just close out. Sometimes music, just to close with some kind of music at the end, helps us digest what we've heard. There's something about, I think, music that helps us get the message from our head into our heart before we head out of here.